The history of Alaska-Russia relations proves that big change can result from small actions. You're listening to Through the Ice Curtain, a Story 49 series where we take a look at the relationships between Alaskans and Russians in the last three decades. In the first episode, we heard about the era of the Ice Curtain, a time when people in Alaska were completely isolated from their family and friends across the Bering Strait. We also heard about a few people who started to melt that ice curtain through things like concert tours, long-distance swimming, and flying balloons across the sea. But today, we'll hear about the event that opened the border for good. And it wasn't a military action or the passage of an international law or anything. It was a single 20-minute flight. And it started with a single man, the man who was flying balloons across the Bering Sea, in fact. This is Jim Stimpfel, a Nome realtor.
Alaska Airlines was having a community advisory meeting here in Nome, and I asked Wiley Scott, who was on the board, if I could pitch the idea of Alaska Airlines to fly to Russia or the Soviet Union. And Wiley said, yeah, I'll see if I can get you on the board. You can speak before the board over there at the Nugget Inn. And so I finally got in to talk, and I made my pitch about the opening of the border and how it would be a wonderful economic opportunity for Alaska Airlines to fly over there and establish border trade, tourism, blah, blah, blah. And then after I spoke, I sat down, and then Jim Johnson said to me, he's the vice president of Alaska Airlines Public Affairs, he said, Jim, we'll call you. And as I walked out of the meeting and walked across the street, I said, oh, my God, I bombed. They're not going to call me. They're not going to do it. So I walked into the Nugget Inn newspaper across the street, and there happened to be a guy named Ken Wells from the Wall Street Journal. He had heard that I was pitching this story, and he said, Jim, tell me the story. So I told him the story, and 2 weeks later, it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Alaska Airlines to fly to Russia, or the Soviet Union back in those days. And I got a call from Alaska Airlines from Jim Johnson, and he said, Jim, we never agreed to do this. How did you get it on the front page of the Wall Street Journal? Well, I just pitched the story. And so Jim said, well, we've had another board meeting down here in Seattle with Bruce Kennedy, who's the CEO of Alaska Airlines, and we've decided to do it. So that was how it got started. June 13th. 1988 was the final date we picked, and we could only carry about 80 people on the flight because Jim Rowe with Bering Air had flown over a few days before to do a compaction test with Alaska Airlines and Bruce Kennedy and the chief pilot Steve Smith to see if the runway would support a 737 jet, because no jet had ever landed there ever before. It was a gravel runway. And so it was determined that we could only carry 80 people, roughly 80 people, 85 people on that flight. And Alaska Airlines and started to plan, well, who goes? How are we going to figure out who gets on the plane? So the governor's office picked, the important dignitary people. Alaska Airlines picked the press, and they left the job of for me to pick who the native people were going to go on the flight. So anyway, we got everyone picked. It was not an easy task to do. There was a lot of intrigue and upsetness between dignitaries and press about who should go and who shouldn't go and everything. So, but we got the plane roughly divided into three groups of people, and that day we left Nome, and for the first time, instead of flying to the right up toward Kotzebue or to the left down toward Anchorage, we went straight across the Bering Strait.
David Ramser was also on the flight.
I was working for Governor Knowles at the time. I was his press secretary and also kind of an advisor on international affairs and primarily the Soviet Union because of my particular interest. And when Cooper took office in 1986, we had no interest in the Soviet Union. Nobody thought they would be unified or relations would be improved. But Alaska Airlines put together this deal with the help of a lot of people to fly the first passenger jet ever between Nome and Providenia. A lot of people were very nervous on the flight because they grew up like me, very suspicious of the Soviet Union. There had been a couple of early reconnaissance flights who were unable to connect with the control tower in Russia. We were worried about getting shot down. Just 5 years earlier, there was a Korean Airlines jet that left from Anchorage flying to Seoul and drifted over Soviet airspace and was blown out of the sky, killing 269 people. And so I think that was on the minds of everybody as we descended through the clouds into Providenia. But once we got there, the reception was so fabulous that everybody put aside all that Cold War paranoia and just established a lot of friendships that continue to this day.
A 20-minute flight, and when the Soviet coastline came in sight, we realized that we were going to land on this runway, which was surrounded by mountains. There was only one way in from the coast, which was level and clear, and then at the end of the runway was another huge mountain or hill, and to the left and to the right were hills, but it was a clear day, and the pilot brought it right down at the end of the runway, and we landed. So it was pretty exciting.
Was it weird that the flight was so short when you'd been separated for so long?
Yeah, that was, we never thought of being that close to Mother Russia before, because most of the time we see a map with Russia or Soviet Union off the side next to Baja, Mexico. So yeah, that was amazing to land in a land that looked like Western Alaska, the tundra, the mountains, the sea, everything looked the same, but it was like a time machine that we had landed someplace with a wholly different architecture and buildings, and it was like being on a different planet. Well, the Soviets at the time had organized all these activities, and so there was a red carpet on the runway. As we got off the runway, the press got off first to shoot pictures, and then the dignitaries got off next, and then the rest of us, and we're all standing in a long line. I look off over to the side here, and I see this long line of people behind a rope, and I mentioned to Tim Galagrigan, I said, "Tim, let's go over and visit those people." So we broke out of the line and headed over to this line of Native kids and Native people that were all smiling. And of course, I didn't know but two words of Russian, Strasvitcha and Dosvidaniya. And Tim spoke Siberian Yupik, so I pulled out a Hershey's chocolate bar, and the kids pulled out all these little pins of Lenin and different things to trade. And Tim saw this woman right behind the kids and started speaking Siberian Yupik. So they started sharing stories of who was still left alive, who of their relatives was still alive and what they were doing. So the press saw us over there talking to these kids, and the press rushed over to us and left the dignitaries by themselves. And that was kind of a chaotic scene, because suddenly that imaginary rope line broke apart and everybody rushed around each other and they were all talking. The Native people who spoke Siberian Yupik didn't need any translators, so they could talk directly in Siberian Yupik, and then translate that to English or translate back to Russian. A lot of the Siberian Yupik people in Pravdenia actually came in from the villages of Laurentia, Lorno, Uelin, Sereniki, Chapolino. We were also looking for people who spoke Inupiat, who knew each other from the Diomedes and Uelin and Laurentia, which is more north. So yeah, we made some lot of contacts of family members that hadn't seen each other or hadn't heard from one of their relatives who used to go back and forth. It was a very exciting moment to see people meet each other for the first time.
It was a tearful, emotional day on the ground over there. I'll remember it for the rest of my life. It really affected me and I think everybody on the flight.
Once the Friendship flight opened the door to Russia, it stayed wide open. Here's David.
Well, after the Friendship flight, the relationship really took off. Alaskans and Russians just were nuts about each other. They wanted to visit every group you can think of, from cold water swimmers in the Soviet Union to beer brewers, wanted to travel across the Bering Strait and do business joint ventures.
I made 9 trips across for various reasons, from the Nome Chamber of Commerce to Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Young Pioneers.
Within a few years, Alaska Airlines started direct air service to many Russian Far East cities. Bering Air and Nome did regular flights to the Soviet Union, hundreds of flights over about a 20-year period.
There was the translator over there, Michael Kazakevich, spoke good English, so we formed a Nome, pro-Nome standard for Pravdenia Nome, where we could issue visas or invitations. We needed an invitation. So we made it easy for groups of people from Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Young Pioneers, trade groups, and even foreign reporters that came to Nome to go to Pravdenia.
Within a few months of the Friendship flight, a big delegation of Soviets came to Nome on what's called the Friendship Float. And they came over on a scientific boat and spent a week in Nome establishing relationships. But it was just a crazy frenzy. Everybody wanted to go back and forth to Russia at the time. There was a little nervousness for a couple of days when the Soviet Union fell. There was a lot of fear that all the progress that had been achieved in establishing friendships across the strait would dry up, but it was pretty short-lived. And Gorbachev left office at the time the Soviet Union fell, and Yeltsin came into office. And Yeltsin kept a lot of his same policies to encourage interactions with the West. So things continued to improve for another 10 years or so under Yeltsin. Alaska Airlines direct flights continued to Russia in the 90s and early 2000s. And so there was a fair amount of interaction. But when Putin came to power in 2000, it became very difficult to deal with Russia. He reined in the authority that had been extended to the regions to deal with the West. And so suddenly it became much more difficult to do any sort of relationships, business, cultural, or educational. And so Alaskans' interest in Russia started to wane. Another problem was the decentralization or the devaluation of the Russian ruble, which resulted in an economic collapse. And so, particularly in the Russian Far East, people were very hard hit. There was not enough coal to generate hot water for heating in apartment buildings. A lot of families basically turned over their children to orphanages because they couldn't keep them warm or keep them fed. And Alaskans did what they could to help out. There was a big food and clothing relief effort that was organized in Anchorage for its sister city of Magadan, but it was a pretty grim situation in the Russian Far East particularly. And so most of these Bering Sea villages in Russia now are back to their subsistence roots. They've organized hunter cooperatives, and so the natives will go out hunting for walrus and whales, and then they share the bounty with the villages, much as is done on the American side. But they're a lot poorer. They don't have the cash economy that a lot of our villages do. Unfortunately, most relations are non-existent. During this 30-year era, when the ice curtain between us was melted, there were about a dozen sister city relationships established, including Nome and Providenia. Most of those have pretty much dried up. Alaskans helped establish more than three dozen Rotary clubs in the Russian Far East. Most of those are pretty inactive. It's very difficult to get to the Russian side. If you want to fly to the Chukotka region, Bering Air will do charters over there, but it's very expensive these days. Otherwise, if you want to get to Magadan, for example, you have to fly to Korea and then up the Russian coast or go through Moscow, which is all the way around the world. So relations are very difficult. We found that there's still a lot of goodwill on the Russian side. Russians love Alaskans. They loved visiting here in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and they would like to again. But it's very expensive, and it continues to be bureaucratic and burdensome.
How do you look back on that time when the border was first opening now?
I thought this was a real important period in Alaska's history. Here you have a relatively little known part of the world, the Bering Strait region, that actually helped do away with the Cold War even before that happened in Germany. The Friendship Flight happened in 1988, which is a full year before the Berlin Wall came down in Germany. And so Alaskans were really at the cutting edge with their colleagues across the Bering Strait and Russia in doing away with the Cold War and improving relations across the strait.
Yeah, well, I guess what I realized was that you can be at the right place at the right time in history with a good idea, and you can open a border.
Sue Steinecker says that her inner compass has always pointed north and west.
And so, you know, I went west to Oregon, went to college, went north, and landed in Fairbanks, but felt like I wasn't where I was supposed to be yet, and finally got an opportunity to work as a seasonal wildlife biologist for 3 months on Little Diomede back in 85 to work with the hunters and collect data on their harvest as well as a lot of biological data with their help. It was a challenging time personally in my life, and Diomede just, I've said they've just sort of wrapped their arms around me and gave me a sense of belonging somewhere. So I just fell in love with the village and with the people there.
Sue eventually settled in Nome, where she got caught up in the Russian fever infecting the city. In the summer of 1989, she was able to cross the border for the first time.
Three different groups of kayakers wanted to paddle across, and they all did it together, and they took a skin boat from Diomede as a support boat. So I got involved getting the Diomeders their passports, and then I ended up traveling with them. And so finally, I got to go across, you know, and I just remember, it's like, as I got out of the boat and stepped on the Eurasian continent, it's like, oh my God, this is the Soviet Union. But then the Soviet Union formally collapsed and everything changed. And it changed dramatically and it changed rapidly. Throughout the Soviet system, you know, they had institutionalized Native life. Whereas on our side, a person hunts when the weather's good, carves ivory when they can, dances when they feel like it, traps if that's part of what they do. Over there, if you were a good ivory carver, you got sent to this one village, and that's what you did 8 hours a day for pay. You were a good hunter, you hunted, you became a hunter for your village, and you worked 8 hours a day. If the hunting's good and it's 5 o'clock, you went home. And the government owned the guns. And so Native life had been sort of dismantled and rebuilt along a Soviet system. And then that system broke. People no longer had access to the boats, the motors, the guns. All of a sudden, the government system that had provided the fuel ships that brought fuel to the villages ceased to operate. And that their region is every bit as cold as ours, if not colder, because it picks up that continental climate. Ours gets moderated by the ocean system. So it broke pretty quickly, and we knew about it through our friends, and the local Native people knew about it through their family members. And then it started getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And yeah, they really tied it up, I think, primarily with the restrictions. And therefore, people weren't traveling as freely. Therefore, Bering Air canceled their scheduled service. They went back to charters. And the charters went on for quite a while. But it really did become very cumbersome to get permissions to go over there.
Sue teamed up with another Nome resident who had a broadcast journalism degree. They submitted a grant proposal and got funding to record interviews. But at the last minute, Sue's partner dropped out. So that left Sue to do the project herself.
So it began with the idea of wanting to just revitalize the discussion.
She ended up with over 70 hours of interviews from people in Alaska and in Chukotka.
So it's April... What is it? 9th?
April 9th.
You're 2000.
2000s.
And this is Klava. Klava, как фамилия?
Макарова.
My name is Debbie Amrock. I'm from Golovin, Alaska.
Меня зовут Алексей Ато. Я из Чукотки, Россия.
Oh my, I'm Yaka. Like I introduce anywhere else, Andras Apostolok is given to me for the convenience of IRS.
Меня зовут Валя Юхак. Я из Кимоска, живу в Сиренниках. У меня есть семья здесь в Сиренниках. Двое детей.
So, and I'm talking with Bob and Vera Metcalf. Vera, what's your maiden name?
King Eikak from Savunga.
Okay. Как вас зовут?
Меня зовут Афанасий Владимирович Маковнев.
She hopes to one day put them in an archive so people can go back, listen, and remember this unique time.
For the 3 years that it was really active here in Nome, it was so exciting. And I mean, it seemed like every other week there was the announcement went out, the Russians are coming. It was such a dramatically exciting time here. And for some reason, it just had so captivated me. And then 10 years later, it was as if it had never happened. There was hardly anybody going back and forth at all. We didn't have internet at that point. It was once again difficult to communicate. And we knew that people were in quite a bit of crisis over there. I mean, there was some communication, but with very little means of reaching out or doing anything about it. So it's like we'd gone from this fabulous party and 10 years later, it was gone. And I thought we needed to remember it. You know, 10 years out, this stuff didn't have as much historic value as it does now 25 years later, because our relationship with Russia keeps changing. it really did become very cumbersome to get permissions to go over there. And it still is.
But there are some people who are trying to change that. More next time on Story 49. Thank you so much to all who made this episode possible. Special thanks to Jim Stimpfel, David Ramser, and Sue Steinecker. Music in this episode was by Mystery Mammal, Kevin McLeod, and Dimension Bucket. If you or someone you know has a story to share, contact KNOM at 443-5221 or by email at story49@knom.org. Story 49, sharing your story, your voice, your Alaska.